Investors Chronicle.
Hello and welcome back to the IC Interviews. I'm Mary McDougall, and joining me today we have Nick Brind and George Barrow, co-managers of Polar Capital Global Financials Trust. Both Nick and George previously worked at HIM Capital, formerly Hiscox Investment Management, which was taken over by Polar Capital in 2010. Nick, George, thank you for joining me. How are you?
Very good. Thank you, Mary. It's nice to be here.
Now, the aftermath of the financial crisis has not been a great decade for the banking sector compared with some other sectors, but your fund has seen very strong performance in recent months, with the share price up about 60% over the past 12 months. Nick, perhaps we'll start with you. How optimistic are you feeling about your current opportunity set?
We feel actually really good about it. Financials, as I'm sure you're aware, represent about 15% of global equity markets, of which around half of that is bank shares. And we see them as one of the biggest beneficiaries of this whole sort of reopening, reflation trade. So, you know, to start with, they're benefiting from the sort of cyclical recovery in their earnings. So obviously banks are needing to set aside less in loan loss provisions and writing back, you know, some of those they took back in 2020 when they assumed the downturn would be much, much, you know, more severe. Insurance companies, you know, similarly had to take losses, you know, last year because of the pandemic, so event cancellations, business interruption policies, etc. And that's obviously not going to repeat. So you've got that cyclical recovery. You've got regulators have removed, you know, the restrictions on capital return. So we're seeing a jump in, you know, dividends and buybacks. And finally, obviously, what's topical at the moment, you know, all about inflation, bond yields and interest rates. You know, banks and insurance to a slightly smaller extent are one of the biggest beneficiaries of any rise in interest rates and bond yields. So it improves their profitability. And probably, you know, against that background, you've got an incredibly cheap sector. In some cases, you know, when you against wider equity markets, it remains very cheap.
So what is the average valuation of the holdings in your fund?
That's a great question. I mean, so if you look at global banks, on average, they're just above one times book. This is the market. Insurance companies probably trade about 1.2 times. For our portfolio, we have a sort of quality bias. We like banks, you know, that have good profitability, good funding, and, you know, obviously that capital return story. So we're trading at a premium to that.
Yeah, and you mentioned inflation earlier. Of course, that is the concern for investors at the moment. To start off with, George, what is your outlook for inflation and interest rates? Are you anticipating prolonged inflation, or do you think we'll return to the lower for longer environment for bond yields that we saw in the years preceding the pandemic?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we have seen some slowdown in terms of growth indicators more recently, but I think we are seeing a number of signs that inflation might be more durable, you know, certainly than the market is expecting. And the market has bought into this whole sort of transitory narrative. But if you look at, you know, what are we seeing because of COVID, probably a shift to more sort of regionalization rather than globalization. So given the need for control over supply chains, you know, we're seeing housing costs rising. And there are signs of wage growth as well. So driven by both rises in minimum wages, but also because of demographic changes. So a number of those we think are more durable than just sort of COVID impacts. You've also got the sort of longer term issues about climate action and the need for sort of major economic transformation around that, which we think will have some sort of inflationary consequences. So, you know, I think we have been in an environment of very low rates and an expectation that those would continue. So it wouldn't take much for that sort of shift expectations to a high rate environment. And that would have a positive impact for our sector.
Yes. So it would have a positive impact because as interest rates rise, that makes banking and lending more profitable. But if it leads to a rise in bad debts, then presumably that's a problem. So it must be a matter of degree, how quickly or how sharply interest rates rise. Nick, where do you think the sweet spot for this might be?
I mean, that's a great question. It's a classic conundrum. I mean, last rate increase cycle we went through back in 2018, most of the banks, you know, saw interest rates needing to get to sort of 4 or 5% before they started to see You know, a significant number of their borrowers probably getting into distress. You know, 3-4 years on, then maybe slightly lower than that. And you've got to think, what would be the impact on markets if interest rates, you know, got close to that? So, yeah, there is a sweet spot. Certainly the first few rate rises, you know, certainly up to a few percent, shouldn't have any major impact on bad debts.
And how does interest rate sensitivity compare for banks across different geographies?
I mean, you know, fundamentally, you know, the big difference is you've got to look at, you know, different loan books, to what extent banks have floating rate loans or fixed rate loans on their balance sheet. So when we look in the US, a lot of the sort of smaller and regional banks have a lot of what they call C&I, commercial industrial loans, what, you know, we'd call corporate loans. And they're generally, you know, floating rate, whereas commercial real estate is tends to be fixed. So you see, you know, some of those banks are very, very sensitive. The other factor is how profitable is a different, you know, banking sector. So some of the Southern European banks, you know, some of the Japanese banks are not very profitable. Their margins have been squeezed by, you know, low interest rates. So any small incremental improvement in the outlook for interest rates feeds through to the bottom line very, very quickly. And you can see some quite sharp changes. Just to try and put some numbers in context, you know, 1% increase in US, you know, interest rates in the first year would increase US banks' earnings by an average by about 13%. Now, because it takes time for loans to reprice, come the second year, then that would increase to by about 20%. And then obviously some of the European, Japanese banks are more sensitive than that. So if that helps put it in context.
Yeah, that's quite significant. After the financial crisis, banks' capital requirements were increased under new regulations. George, do you think now globally that bank capital level requirements are about right, or do you think they might have gone too far?
Well, I mean, I think we've had a real live stress test with the pandemics of unprecedented levels of, you know, of economic slowdown and dislocation, and we've seen, you know, the system, the sector hold up well throughout it, and, you know, certainly there has been support from government schemes as well. But I think, you know, it's shown to be a much more resilient sector than we had in the previous cycle. I think it's unlikely that regulators are going to relax standards much. But equally, I think we've got much more visibility as to the future. And I think that makes a big difference in terms of expectations on capital return and sort of outlook for dividends and buybacks. So I think we're in a because of the experience during the most recent downturn with COVID, we're likely to have a more settled regulatory environment. And, you know, that's a key positive, because post the GFC, you know, we had 10 years of capital build, of regulatory standards ratcheting up, and the consequences of the GFC. And I think this downturn has been very different in that term.
Yeah, thank you. Nick, so sort of developing that paints a more positive picture, but what do you think are the biggest threats to banking stability now? Like, could it be liquidity or tapering or cybercrime or something else? What are your biggest potential threats, do you think?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. I mean, you know, for us, the key thing when we're looking at the banking sector is, you know, are their balance sheets strong, which, you know, George has obviously just touched on. You know, you in the US, for example, you have to go back to the 1930s to a time when they had more capital than they do today. So there's a tick in the box there. Do they have plenty of liquidity? Yes. You know, again, change in regulatory requirements post the GFC. So fundamentally, you know, banking is very sound. The other crime they committed, you know, pre-GFC was that they allowed their underwriting standards to relax. So if we think back to, you know, Northern Rock lending 125% loan-to-value mortgages, so-called ninja loans in the US, you know, no income, no job, or no assets, and that's when you look at where banks have failed. It's because they've relaxed their underwriting, they're lending money to people, you know, or to businesses that they shouldn't. So from that perspective, you know, it's hard to see, you know, where they come, you know, undone. But, you know, like any business, you know, cybercrime, that's always a risk, and you have to be cognizant of that. and that affects not just banks but everybody.
A fifth of the portfolio, according to your latest fact sheet, is invested in Asia. George, how confident are you about the stability of the Asian banks? Could Chinese real estate group Evergrande's recent troubles be a catalyst for further defaults in the property sector, which is such an important part of China's economy?
Yeah, so in terms of our exposure in the trust, we invest in areas like the private sector banks in India and Indonesia. So these are very well capitalized, very profitable, you know, well-run banks. You know, HDFC Bank in India, BCA in Indonesia. You know, we've followed these for many cycles. You know, we're confident in terms of their ability to weather downturns, and we've certainly seen that this cycle. You know, we don't have exposure to Chinese banks in the trust, and we've struggled in terms of transparency there, and often we find that sort of loans are made not on sort of purely commercial reasons. So, you know, for that reason, you know, our exposure in China is not through the banks. But in terms of Evergrande, you know, we think there will be some impact in terms of the Chinese banks with exposure in terms of provisioning in the second half. But we do think the government will probably be able to contain the spillover risk. So, you know, ensuring completion of Evergrande projects which were pre-sold, or ensuring home buyers, you know, access to mortgages. So I think there is a ability for them to contain that spillover risk.
Okay. And Nick, I just looking down the list of your holdings, I see that HSBC is one of the few UK banks in there, but the majority of its profits come from Asia. What's your outlook for HSBC?
I'll let George take that, if that's all right.
Okay, yeah. Please, go ahead, George.
Yeah, so I mean, I think we see a number of catalysts for it. It's a stock which has underperformed, you know, this year. It's been weighed down by China, political risk, and then concerns about property. But it's also had earnings upgrades coming through it. So we've seen it derate and look at interesting in terms of valuations. You know, it's exposed to high rates, not just in the UK, but also in the US. And in Asia, particularly in Hong Kong. So around 25 basis points rate increase adds about $1.5 billion to their net interest income. It's about a 10% uplift to their earnings. So, you know, clearly very sensitive to rising rates. It's trading at a big discount to book value. And so, you know, we think from a valuation point of view, it's attractive with clear catalysts, and it has excess capital to pay, you know, an attractive yield around 5% plus and buybacks to come through. So having been unloved, you know, I think it is looking interesting. And then sits alongside our UK exposure, where we have a specialist bank, One Savings Bank, which, you know, we've preferred for a long period of time. You know, it generates high teens return on equity, continues to take market share from the large cap banks. You know, we think it looks well placed to continue to grow.
And just more generally, how confident are you feeling about banks within the emerging markets at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, I think they're very sort of different grouping, but, you know, overall, so EM have fewer macro imbalances than they had in previous periods of US rate rises, so they should be in a better position to handle that. But, you know, it will clearly depend on which part of EM, and I think historically we've had a preference for Asia, given that they're stronger funding positions and generally better capital positions. So we think there's greater resilience there, and that's been reflected in the trust holdings.
Yeah. And I mentioned earlier that you have a low allocation to UK banks. Why is this?
Yeah, I think we've, as mentioned, looked to play it through the specialist banks with the large cap banks. I think the outlook has improved for them, and they will be beneficiaries potentially of rising rates coming through next year. In terms of Lloyds, which we sold, end of last year, then we had some concerns about the level of mortgage competition coming through. So whilst we might get rate rises as a positive, we're seeing some pretty fierce competition in terms of front book mortgage spreads, which could offset that rate rise benefit. In particular with Lloyds, you know, some people have also noted the risk related to the pension deficit, which potentially could offset, you know, could impact capital return. You also have a new CEO coming in, so in terms of strategy, a little bit unclear there. So if we're looking to play rate rises, you know, we think there are sort of other ways to do that at the moment.
Nick, there's been a sort of boom in IPOs and M&As recently. To what extent has has your fund benefited from this, both in terms of banks working on the deals and being participants themselves?
Yes. So, you know, JP Morgan's our largest holding, as you've seen. So they've been a, you know, big beneficiary of that. I mean, historically, we've preferred the more traditional retail and commercial banks, or universal banks, as they're also called, over the pure investment banks. So we don't own Goldman Sachs. We do have a holding in Morgan Stanley. We don't own Barclays, for instance. And the driver behind that is, you know, it's the volatility of returns. You know, markets don't like volatility, so they like to put a multiple on what they believe is a sustainable return. And therefore, when you look at the most highly rated banks globally, they tend to be either those that are growing faster, but, you know, more often it's the ones that have a higher quality income stream, you know, some of the custody banks in the US, or those who have, you know, payment subsidiaries, you know, and so forth. So we've always been a little bit cautious around some of the investment banks, but, you know, we still very much benefited from that trend in recent months.
Yeah, I had noticed that. I was going to ask about the absence of Goldman Sachs and Barclays, so that yes. makes sense. There's also, there's been a bit of a trend of investment banks moving more into the retail wealth management robo-advice space. You've got JPM Chase in the UK bought Nutmeg, and Goldman Sachs Marcus is setting up robo-advice products. Do you think is this a trend that will continue, and do you think it's a threat to the more traditional wealth managers?
Yes, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, it's definitely interesting what you know, some of the moves that they've been making. I mean, it's still very small fish for some of these banks. You know, what JP Morgan's doing in the UK with Chase, they've obviously only just launched their app. It's going to take, you know, it's a very long-term project. So as we've seen with, you know, a number of the startup digital banks in the UK, the likes of, you know, Monzo, Starling, etc., it takes a long time for that to feed through to profitability and returns. So it's a competitive threat in the very, very long term. But, you know, in the very short term, it's all going to be driven by macro events.
Yeah. And it looks like you don't have much exposure to asset and wealth management companies. But the big banks, as we've said, do tend to have these arms. Do you think asset management companies on their own are less attractive investments than the big banks?
No, far from it. So we've done extremely well. We've had a holding in Blackstone. So when you look at the asset management sector, the sort of what you call the alternative asset managers, so the likes of Blackstone, Apollo, KKR, etc., have you know, performed fantastically well. They've seen huge growth in assets under management as people look to, you know, access, you know, private credit, private equity, you know, direct real estate, direct lending, it's, you know, and other areas. And so, you know, that's performed incredibly well for us. Our concern about the traditional asset managers has just been that, you know, the headwinds from, you know, a shift as people have moved into either into passives or into more specialized funds, or, you know, into alternatives. So they've seen, you know, difficulty in raising flows, and also that pressure on fees. Again, when you're competing against, you know, ETFs and passive funds. So that's why we've had a preference there for the likes of Blackstone.
I guess also quite a lot of the asset management companies aren't listed. So in terms of your sectors, you've got the majority in banking, and then you have diversified financials, which includes, you know, the private equity alternative managers, as you said. You've got payments companies and insurance companies. Which of these sectors, George, are you most excited about?
Well, I mean, I think around 70% of the trust is within the banking sector at the moment. So, I mean, that's an area clearly that, you know, we think is best positioned at the moment at this point of the cycle. As Nick was saying, given where valuations are, given the sensitivity to rising rates, you know, it does look particularly well positioned to re-rate from here and to benefit from earnings upgrades. You know, it's been, you know, faced headwinds from a low rate environment for a long period of time, and I think people have assumed that would continue. So you are getting starting to get a bit of a re-evaluation of the outlook. And whilst it has seen some recovery, it still trades at an attractive discount to the broader market. So I think that, you know, that's the area that we're most positive on at the moment.
Yeah, I guess you'd have to say that, as it's your largest sector. But Nick, what do you think about the relative value of the insurance sector?
Yeah, no, so we do like the insurance sector. It trades on a slightly higher multiple than the banking sector and historically. So, I mean, for us, you know, about 2/3 of our exposure is in non-life or property casualty insurance companies. So to give examples, you know, things like, you know, Direct Line, which you'll know well in the UK, or Chubb in the US, or Sampo in Scandinavia. And, you know, we've liked that because it's historically defensive, you know, it's counter-cyclical because obviously it's, you know, losses are driven by weather-related losses or accidents. Last year was obviously a bit of a black swan event. You saw, you know, losses around obviously COVID to do with business interruption, event cancellation. So you've seen an acceleration in rate increases for insurance. And as a consequence, we think over the next 2 to 4 years, actually the outlook's very good. However, in the short term, you know, people are either concerned about, well, I'm owning some of the sort of faster growing sectors in the market like tech or healthcare, or I'm playing at the other end of the barbell, maybe I'm playing some of the more recovery stories, whether that's banks or other cyclical sectors. And non-life has fallen a little bit between those two stools, so it has lagged recently. But we think, you know, the outlook's good. In the short term, as you know, as George was saying, we're positioned more in banks to take, you know, obviously take advantage of that cyclical recovery.
And another theme in the fund is payments companies. You own Visa and MasterCard. There is some talk of buy now, pay later companies such as Klarna and Afterpay taking market share from traditional credit card companies. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, it's become a real theme. They're growing rapidly. I mean, I think we're seeing a wide range of people also offer buy now, pay later. So, you know, as will MasterCard, as will PayPal, and Klarna, which is the dominant player in Europe and increasingly in the US. I mean, it's an interesting theme. We'll have to see how the regulator responds to it. So I think that's an area that's a potential risk for it, particularly given the demographic that they're often targeting, sort of younger borrowers. But no, I think it's certainly here to stay. It's a real growth theme. We're seeing it globally as well. So payment companies in India, Paytm, which, you know, has very successful in terms of growing a customer base there, 330 million customers, but, you know, we're struggling to monetize that. And they're now using buy now, pay later as a route to monetization and profitability. So they're IPOing later, I think, this month. So I think, you know, it's definitely a growing trend. It's coming from quite a small base, and it's going to drive significant growth. And I think, you know, we'll continue to take market share from the car companies.
And Nick, another growing trend that's not quite developed yet, but it's really interesting and difficult to understand the implications of, is central bank digital currencies, which do theoretically have the potential to upend the global banking system. All the central banks are looking into them. China, it would seem, is leading the way. What are your thoughts on how the concept is developing?
I think, yeah, it is early days. I mean, a lot of central banks are looking into it. It remains to be seen sort of what structure, what form it comes in. So I think from what we've read, maybe they put a cap of about €3,000 on retail deposits held at the central bank. If that was the case, then you are going to get a loss of deposits within the banking system that potentially would lead to higher funding costs. And the kind of analysis we've seen suggests about a 2%, 3% impact to NII, which could lead to around a 7% impact to pre-tax profit. So it would be negative for the banking system. But I think bearing in mind, it's unlikely that the central bank would introduce something which destabilizes their own banking system. So I think it is going to come in some form. It's a bit early to assess what impact it would have. But I don't think central banks want to disintermediate their own banking system. But it will, you know, accelerate that whole process of digitization of payments. And so, you know, those companies would ultimately be winners, you know, the companies that are benefiting from that whole structural shift from cash to digital.
Yeah, I was going to ask if you've sort of been thinking about which companies might be the winners and the losers. Would you think it would play into the hands of the payments companies and be more worrying for the banks?
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be negative for the banks, but yeah, as noted, difficult to know to what extent. But I think that whole process of digitization is just accelerating. We've seen that during COVID. You know, we'd see that with digital currencies. And so, you know, we know they would be beneficiaries of that process. You know, there's questions later down the line about the margins that some of these payment companies can charge. I think, you know, that's, you know, a question about the sustainability of some of their returns. But, you know, it's a long way to go in terms of that process of shifting from cash to digital payments.
And just another question about banks. In terms of your US and European holdings, which ones do you view as better quality?
I mean, historically, we've had a preference for the US over Europe, and within Europe, probably the sort of Nordic banks over, you know, Eurozone and other banks. And in the case of the US, I mean, the reasons for that is largely better profitability, better growth, and, you know, perhaps less regulatory intrusion at the margin. But, you know, you've also got the opportunity, you know, there's still close to 5,000 banks in the US. You know, a few hundred of those are listed. So you can, you know, we got exposure to some Californian banks that are growing much faster than, let's say, some of the banks based up in the northeast of the US, where obviously, you know, some of those old rust bucket states, you're not seeing as far, you know, as much growth. So there's the ability to find some really interesting niche banks there. But, you know, key for us has always been, you know, do banks make a sensible return on capital, on you know, on equity? You know, what kind of risks are they taking? Do they have a good funding structure, etc.? And the difficulty with, you know, in Europe, when you've had low or negative interest rates, that's really pressured their business models. Now, with the Scandinavian banks, they've been very good at cutting costs and digitizing to offset that. So, you know, DNB, which is Norway's largest bank, for example, has closed something like 80% of its branch network over the last 10 years and seen no loss of market share, or no notable loss of market share. And therefore still actually, you know, they're still making a decent return. So, yeah, there's nuances within it, but probably, you know, the US has been a preference.
And across geographies, is something we haven't spoken about yet, is stagflation a concern for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not a positive scenario for the sector. But I think, as we, you know, what can we do? We can look back to previous periods where we saw this. In the 70s, we actually, you know, it's a period in which we did see banks outperform, but it was negative for equity markets overall. So, you know, we have to see the extent to which, you know, growth, you know, surprises on the downside and inflation, you know, the outlook for that as well. But I think, you know, it wouldn't be a positive scenario, but it could be relatively positive for the sector, as we saw before. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think in that environment where you're more likely to see interest rates rising by more than the market currently expects, then at least within banks and to a lesser extent insurance companies, you've got some tailwind that are benefiting the businesses, where, you know, other sectors might struggle, especially sort of some of the long duration sectors like technology and healthcare, you know, trading on much, much higher multiples.
And just in terms of the dividend, the trust managed to keep paying its dividend out of revenue reserves. That's one of the attractiveness of the closed-end structure, is that they can smooth out dividend payments. What's the current state of your reserves, and when do you forecast that the dividend might be fully covered again?
Yeah, so the trust was launched in 2013 with a sort of income and growth mandate, so yield of about 3%. Every single year prior to the pandemic, we generated more income than we paid out in dividends and built up some decent revenue reserves. So not surprisingly, we had to dip into them in 2020. Again, this year, we'll be dipping into the revenue reserves to a much smaller extent. And next year, you know, that might well be the case again. But we're seeing a very sharp recovery in dividends, obviously, coming through from the sector, as, you know, regulators have relaxed those restrictions. So that's something that, you know, the board and ourselves, you know, as a manager, will have to review at some point over the next year.
And you cut the fee at yes. at the beginning of last year and changed the performance fee. Do you plan to keep the fee structure as it is?
Yes, there's no plans to change that. That was negotiated with the board. Obviously, there's been management fees have declined over time. And part of the reconstruction, when the trust life was extended indefinitely, was a renegotiation of that fee. So there's no plans for that to change for the foreseeable future.
Okay, great. Well, I'm afraid that's all we've got time for now. But that was really helpful. Great overview of the trust. And I'm sure your shareholders will be very happy with its recent performance. And thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you.
Thank you.